Hi, I'm Richard Karn, and you may have seen me on TV talking about the world's number one expandable garden hose. Well, the brand new Pocket Hose Copperhead with Pocket Pivot is here, and it's a total game changer. Old-fashioned hoses get kinks and creases at the spigot, but the Copperhead's Pocket Pivot swivels 360 degrees for full water flow and freedom to water with ease all around your home. When you're all done, this rust-proof anti-burst hose shrinks back down to pocket size for effortless handling and tidy storage. Plus, your super light and ultra-durable pocket hose Copperhead is backed with a 10-year warranty. What could be better than that? I'll tell you what, an exciting exclusive offer just for you. For a limited time, you can get a free pocket pivot and their 10-pattern sprayer with the purchase of any size Copperhead hose. Just text WATER to 64000. That's WATER to 64000 for your two free gifts with purchase. W-A-T-E-R to 64000.
By texting 64000, you agree to receive recurring automated marketing messages from Pocket Hose. Message and data rates may apply. No purchase required. Terms apply. Available at pockethose.com/terms.
And welcome to the Your Favorite Band podcast, a podcast where we talk to your favorite bands about how your favorite bands became your favorite bands. I'm Bran, and as usual, I'm with my good friend Dave. Dave, how's it going, bud?
Oh, man. Bran, I'm on the edge of my seat.
Why are you on the edge of your seat?
It's 6-4, Bran. They just went up. The Indians are back in it, of sorts.
Wow.
Bottom of the eighth.
What a thing. Yep. We are recording this the last inning of Game 7, or almost the last inning of Game 7 of the World Series. And we've got
really bad timing, don't we?
We do. We thought there's no one I'd rather talk to during the most important game of baseball of all time than Paper Route. And so that's what we're doing.
Here we are. You know, it's a topic of tension between the band, because this is Chad and I'm from Chicago and JT is from the Cleveland area. So we're
Oh my gosh.
Wow.
Are you
lots of tension inside the band right now?
Are you a diehard Cubs fan?
I am.
Wow.
Honestly, I'm not even a huge sports guy, but it's crazy right now.
Dude, I feel really bad that we're doing this now that I know that you're from Chicago.
That's all right. I promise I don't have the TV on in the background and mute.
All right.
Listen, well, here's the thing. This kind of brand goes perfectly into our spinoff podcast, which is watching sports with your favorite people.
That's right. It's called the Watching Sports with Your Favorite Bands. It's like we don't even talk about music. We just talk about the sports that we're... It's an awful
and get reactions off. Play-by-play reactions from your favorite band while they watch their favorite sports teams.
Yeah.
That would be really boring. Well, maybe if JT and Nick are around, that'd be fun. But the sports that I enjoy and partake in... someone asked me tonight what my favorite sport is to watch, and I said I think when I watch Wimbledon, I like watching tennis.
Oh, you're one of those.
Nice.
I'm like so...
One of those.
Yeah, I'm like, I played volleyball, I like tennis, I like martial arts. I'd like the standard like basketball, baseball, football, like just stuff that I never really connected with.
That's okay. See, like
alternative music and alternative sports.
Yes, exactly. Alternative music and alternative sports.
That's what it's all
That's
about.
How you do it.
Football is a nickelback of sports.
That's exactly right.
Oh my gosh, what a combo.
Or the quarterback, if you will. You see what I did?
The All-American nickelbackers.
No, I actually do like... I'm actually becoming a football fan for the first time in a long time.
Who are you cheering? Are you cheering for the Bears?
I'm cheering for myself because I'm doing fantasy football.
Oh, good.
So, there he is. Good choice. That gets them all in.
Oh, there's a home run. There's a home run.
Oh my gosh. Are they really going to do this? They're going to go into the ninth?
Oh, like this? My gosh.
Man,
it's tied up. It is tied up. This is crazy.
What the heck?
Sorry, we got to stay on.
I know. I love that I'm talking to somebody from Chicago while this is happening.
I know. I know, it could get really intense.
If at some point you need to scream or curse, if that's your thing, then you can do that.
There's a chance this will last the whole interview.
We can bleep me out later, right?
No, this is the internet. Listen, we can say whatever we want. Let's take our minds off it for a moment as much as we can and talk about Paper Route. Because I'm excited to talk about Paper Route. I'm a big Paper Route fan, so it's a joy to talk to you about Paper Route. Before we dive into the albums and the recording process and the writing processes, talk about kind of life before Paper Route and the music projects that you were a part of beforehand and how Paper Route came to be.
Yeah, well, basically, JT and I met in 2000, long, long time ago. And he was in a band with my cousin. And so that's how I met JT. And so I transferred colleges and went to the same college as him. And we started a band together. I was actually like the last person to join the band. They needed a bass player. So I joined that band, and then that band started playing shows and touring, ended up moving to Nashville, and then we broke up.
Oh, no.
Sad story, but true. So that band, at that point, I'm like, well, my days of being in a band are over. JT's days of being in a band, he thought were over. And so that was like kind of more of like a traditional rock band. And I was kind of getting kind of like bored with rock music, I think, at that point. And so I bought a laptop. I saved up, bought a laptop, and I got back into like electronic music.
Yeah.
And I'd always been into like programming beats since I was a kid, actually. And so I just started programming beats on a laptop and making tracks and stuff and kind of doing my own thing just for my own personal enjoyment.
Yeah. Was that first band more of a traditional rock band or?
Yes. Okay. Yeah. It was more traditional. I mean, it still wasn't like just rock and roll. It was, it was kind of along the lines of like something like Jimmy Eat World.
Okay.
We're all like huge, like, you know, Clarity fans and stuff like that.
Sure.
Sunny Day Real Estate, that kind of thing. So, but since I was a kid, I'd always been like programming beats, and my dad's a computer teacher. And so I would like go to school before class started and make beats on the computers there.
Mm-hmm.
And, at that point I kind of got back into it, and, laptops were kind of becoming a new way to make music. So I bought a laptop, and I was really into like Bjork and Massive Attack and, that kind of thing at the time. So I just started making beats and song ideas.
Nice.
So, I had this idea that I wanted to make a bunch of music where I was the common thread and have a bunch of different guest vocalists sing on it. Cause I'm not really a singer, you know, and I thought it'd be cool to collaborate with a bunch of people.
Yeah.
And so I had this idea for this kind of like, I like the hip hop mentality where like you have a record with like 10 or 12 different people on it, you know?
Right.
Right.
So I had this idea, but then, you know, JT came over and I played him a song and he wanted to like work on it with me. So, you know, I was like, yeah, this would be great. You know, obviously we're friends already and we have a history together. So we wrote a song. And then we wrote another one, and then we wrote another one. And before we knew it, we kind of had this like studio project going, and it went from, you know, me thinking he would be one of the singers to like, we just wanted to do everything together, the two of us, you know? So that's what we did. And we ended up making a 6-song EP, and our friend Andy asked us to produce his record, and we decided to just work on it all together. And so the three of us became Paper Route. You know, we took Andy's songs and JT songs and my songs and kind of just jammed them all together and just recorded it in mostly my bedroom and my living room. So that was the first thing that became Paper Route. And then we just burnt, you know, 100 copies and left them around coffee shops in Nashville.
Yeah, that's great. That's a great story.
That's awesome. And when, what year was that that you were doing that?
That was probably 2004.
Right.
I was like, I was young enough to still like look like, you know, I like snuck into Belmont to, you know, use their pianos and stuff like that. So
that's awesome.
I don't know if I could get away with that now. So anyways, so cool. Sorry, let me know if I'm going too long.
Oh no, you're fine. This
no, no, that's fine.
Down later. So basically, at that point, it was just a studio project. There was no, intent for it to be a band. We thought we were too old for that. We'd already lived out our band dreams and whatnot. And so that was just it. It was just a 6-song EP and it was done. And so then I had been talking to some producers and mixers in town. I was just like hanging out with them. I would just email them and ask them if I could take them to coffee. And so I met a producer named Jakir King, who's pretty well known. At the time, he was really well respected, but he's done stuff with like Tom Waits and Norah Jones and Kings of Leon and Dawes. And he's kind of like one of the biggest producers right now.
Wow.
And so I just like started hanging out with him and became friends with him and kind of like forced him to become my mentor. And so one day we were at lunch and he told me like, you know, you should think about going to this recording school in Ohio that I went to. And so I put in my 2 weeks notice at this office job I was working and enrolled in this place called the Recording Workshop and just went there for 5 weeks and just studied recording.
That's awesome.
So then I came back. Awesome. Yeah, so then I came back and I emailed another producer to say, like, hey, can I live in your studio? And he said no. And then I emailed one more time and he's like, okay, fine, you can do it. So I lived in his studio and I tried to stay out of the way during the day and help him out if he needed help, which he never needed help. And then at night I would just use the studio and record and write and just make my own songs. And I kind of realized that like my first instrument was like the studio or the computer. So I'm not that great of a piano player. I'm not that great of a bassist. But when I have kind of like everything at my disposal, that's kind of when I felt most creative and most like I had the most fun doing that.
Yeah.
So in the meantime, people, MySpace is starting to become a thing and people start discovering those old 6 songs we did a year or two earlier. And a tiny little label hits us up and was like, hey, can we put this EP out? And I was like, yeah, sure, of course. But, you know, just to let you know, we're like not a band or anything. Like, that's just it. Like, it's just the 6 songs and that's all that there is. So, anyways. So they're like, okay, cool, yeah, we'll give you guys a little bit of money, and you know, here it is. So, so then, long story short, actually, I'm not making this short at all. I apologize.
Listen, but, we got all the time in the world, man.
So we got all the time in the world. Series.
It's true.
Well done.
That's true. So it's getting close to our EP coming out and they're like, and the label guy's like, hey, I know you guys said you're not a band, but like, it would be really awesome if you guys can like play like one show just for your CD release, just because, you know, my investors awesome. And stuff need you to play something. I was like, I'll try to talk the guys into it, but I don't know. And since then, I'd written like a bunch of songs. I kind of had like a writing growth spurt basically. And so I hit up JT and Andy and I took them to like a sandwich place. I was like, I know this is lame, but that like label that wants to put this thing out wants to, us to play a show. And so will you guys do it? And they're like, fine, we'll play like one show. That's it.
Were you secretly like super like hoping that they would be into it?
I knew they would be. I knew that as soon as JT got on stage, that he would like, it would just come back, and he would catch the fever again. And sure enough, you know, one show became three shows, you know.
Yeah.
We had one show, and then it's like, well, we need a couple, like, kind of warm-up shows to get to that show.
Right.
So then that started that train, and then, you know, I'd, like, written a bunch of songs, which slowly became, like, some of the first songs on Absence, which is our first full-length, and also mm-hmm. the ones on this EP called Are We All Forgotten. I had a couple of tracks that I had written that or at least had like the majority of it. And then JT and Andy obviously had their own ideas too. So it just kind of like turned back on, and then we just didn't stop.
Yeah.
Since then.
That's awesome.
So we just started playing shows, played South by Southwest, manager started hitting us up, label started hitting us up, and what was a studio project became a band again. It was like the weirdest thing. It's like everything we didn't expect it to be, it became.
So, yeah.
And then like bigger bands became fans of us and started taking us on tour to open for them.
Yeah.
So that's kind of been the arc of the band. It just started in my bedroom because I had insomnia and I couldn't sleep. And I just wanted to make music.
Yeah.
In the middle of the night instead of just lay there awake. So that's how it happened.
That's great.
It's beautiful.
Yeah, and so that's you, the...
And what time would you say you were at this point when you guys were decided to actually go and do this as a band rather than it being a studio? What year was that?
Well, we recorded that stuff in 2004. I think the label put it out in 2006. And we put out a Christmas EP. And then, you know, some of that stuff got put into the movie 500 Days of Summer. And then we started working on more music. And then we met the manager of the Killers, who became our attorney. And then we just started talking to other managers and labels. And then we went on tour with Paramore, like a national tour. So
nice.
I don't know. That's everything awesome. Just kind of like happened. You know, yeah. It was a lot of hard work on our parts, but those are like the big...
A lot of networking of like, too, it sounds like.
Yeah, I guess. I don't know. I don't even know what networking means. But yeah, I don't know. I just think, you know, it was a fun time.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah, for sure.
So,
and you guys signed to Universal pretty early on. A lot of bands start, well, I guess you guys kind of did have the EP go out, but what was it like releasing your first full length on such a big label?
Yeah, we were signed to Universal Motown, so, which is weird just to say you're signed to Motown, because it's like, it's not really Motown. It was like, you know, Universal at some point in the past, you know, 40 years had bought Motown or something, right. But technically we're on Motown.
Right. How did that come to be?
The head of the label was a huge fan of, like, they said he's like an Anglophile, which I guess he means he likes British music. And so, I guess our music kind of like fit into that kind of vibe. So, he awesome. Just heard the stuff and liked it.
Yeah.
So, I don't know. He just became a fan of it.
Yeah.
Came out and saw us play and like, wanted to sign us and said we could make the record we wanted to make. So we did, you know, we produced that whole record ourselves and I recorded most of it and mixed half of it. And, we didn't really know what we were doing, but we kind of set a precedent in a lot of ways in terms of like us recording a lot ourselves and like kind of getting out of town. We like, got a house like an hour and a half away. So, and just set up our studio there and like wrote and recorded songs.
Right. That's great. Do you feel like you said that you got to record the album you wanted to? So there wasn't any pressure from the label to change your sound or your style or anything like that. You felt like you could kind of be who you wanted to be.
Yeah, that's how I remember it. We had a lot of free reign, you know.
That's great. Yeah. I just ask because there's a lot of stories from bands that go on bigger labels especially starting smaller, and it changes the way that they want it to go. Like some bands have great stories, and some bands are like, it was a train wreck. So.
Right. Well, the train wreck's coming. Don't worry. So yeah, we basically
excited.
Yeah, we recorded our record, and like we had our, you know, the big song, or the song that was supposed to be the big song, was called Carousel.
Yeah.
And which was one of the ones that, you know, was started back when I was living in that guy's studio, and they heard that and Are We All Forgotten, and then wanted to sign us. So we did that, and right before the album came out, like the head president guy of the label got a promotion and moved over to like the international label. International, like Universal International, which I think might have, I don't know if he moved buildings or if he like actually moved to like the UK or something, but all of a sudden like our biggest champion at the label, the most powerful guy there, was no longer there. And so we kind of lost our champion. So
yeah,
that album came out, but it didn't really have any kind of radio plan, or there wasn't very much kind of marketing plan for it.
Sure. Yeah.
So we just ended up touring a lot, and like every record we sold by hand at shows, because, you know, it wasn't getting in stores. It was in the wrong part of iTunes.
Yeah, I was surprised when I was looking through the history and stuff to see that you were signed to Universal, because as I remember Absence, it's what you were describing. Like, it seemed like a small label release, but it was on a big label. So it was just, that's interesting that that's how that played out.
Yeah, exactly. And I guess I'm proud of that. I'm proud that we were on a major label and had a very independent approach to it, you know?
Right, for sure.
So,
because I mean, you still grew organically. I feel like I heard about Carousel somehow, like it just, somebody sent it to me and said you'd like it or something like that. So it wasn't like I was hearing it all over the place. It was just one of those things that popped up. And I think that's how a lot of people found you guys. It's through that song, but just through different people kind of sending it around the internet or whatever.
Yeah. Yeah. It was, Carousel. We put Carousel out before we actually were signed, I think. I think we had to like take it back down because we got signed and wanted to save it for when our album came out.
Yeah.
So that was the short story of that. And then, but that album didn't like blow up, you know, we didn't become the world's next, Coldplay or whatever, you know?
Yeah.
Go ahead.
I was just going to say it didn't blow up, but I still like, as like, I feel like it did relatively well. Like, it went on like what the Billboard whatever it's called, the Heat Seekers or whatever.
Heat Seekers.
And there was some buzz around it. Like, I feel like 2009, there was like the internet was starting to be a place where people would go to find like new music, and not just download, not just download stuff that they heard on the radio, but to find new stuff. I feel like it did relatively well, but in comparison to being a major label release, it like wasn't breaking any records or anything. So,
right, yeah, there just wasn't. I think we just kind of like fell through some of the cracks when it came down to like the marketing and release of the album.
Sure,
because we kind of lost our big champion, and so the only plan was to just tour like crazy. So we did.
Right.
We toured and toured and toured and toured and made a lot of fans that way and opened for a lot, you know, much more successful and established bands.
Yeah.
And so then we had to make another record.
Yeah.
So.
So, So after Absence, there was a bit of transitional stuff, like with Andy leaving for whatever reason, mm-hmm. and then major leaving the major label, joining. I don't even know what Tree of Hearts record is. So what is that? but also, like, what was the transitional time like between 2010 and 2012 in the life of Paper Route before going in to record the second album?
Well, basically, we were on the road a lot.
Yeah.
And that really, it's pretty taxing. I don't know if you guys have ever toured, but it's not really that fun, to be honest.
Right.
The way we tour.
Sure.
You know, we're in a van in trailer, and, you know, we're, and a lot of times we're on bus tours, and so that means everyone's on a bus except for us, you know, so we're on crazy bus routing, and that means, you know, we'd sleep very little, you know, sharing beds with each other oftentimes, mm-hmm. eating terrible food that makes you feel gross, and you don't have any privacy, you know, you can't even, you know, pee by yourself. So,
right.
So all that being said, I'm not trying to be a whiner, although I am, I apologize. All that being said, we were pretty like exhausted.
Yeah.
So we were kind of like, didn't have much gas in our tank. So we were all kind of like in very frazzled places when it came time to make the next record. And, you know, I don't even know where to start. We were all kind of going through like different personal things. So, my mom was diagnosed with cancer, and so that kind of like hit me like a ton of bricks. We had some business managerial kind of issues that we ended up having to part ways with our first manager, and that was not too fun.
Yeah,
and a very tough thing. Andy couldn't keep going and touring at the intensity and just with the intensity that we were doing. I think that he needed something that was less taxing, and I just don't think that he liked the touring lifestyle.
Yeah.
And so he said he needed a change, and we said that, you know, for what we want to do, like, we just don't feel like there can be a change. Like, we really feel like we just need to keep going. And so, you know, he felt like he needed to leave, you know? Yeah. So, and then JT was going through a divorce. Which, you know, I don't want to speak too much on his behalf.
Sure.
But that is a lot of that's in. So a lot, there's a lot of stuff going on in that second record when it came time to make that second record.
Was there a thought before going into the studio to just to hang it up? Like, with all those transitional pieces and all the crap going on, like, was there a question of if it's worth it or not?
Yeah, I think so. I think that came more right before this previous record. But we'll get there. But
right.
But yeah, I think for that record, I think that, you know, I was driven, and JT was driven for different reasons. I was driven because I finally felt like I found something that, you know, gave me an identity and gave my life more meaning. And I also just loved creating music, and I had big dreams.
Yeah.
And JT is kind of wired from a similar place, you know? And so I think that quitting didn't even really seem like that much of an option because it probably, maybe at the time, it kind of gave us an unhealthy amount of like self-worth or something,
yeah,
to be honest.
Yeah.
You know?
Right.
So I think it was too much a part of like what we felt like gave us validity as humans or something.
Sure.
So,
yeah.
So no, we didn't consider slowing down for a split second.
Yeah.
And maybe we should have, honestly, like looking back, maybe we should have, but we didn't. So, and Andy,
I'm glad you didn't.
Well, I guess that's good. Yeah. Andy needed to slow down. Andy needed to slow down. So, and we weren't willing to accommodate that. And so we had to part ways. Yeah. That was not easy.
Yeah.
So,
okay. Yeah.
So that was going into the second record. And this time we, instead of going like an hour outside of Nashville, we, rented a house, a humongous house in East Nashville that we dubbed, Joy Mansion. So, cause it was of the part of town it was at and stuff. So, and it was like this massive 7,000 square foot, like plantation house from, the mid 1800s that was haunted. And so we put our whole studio in there and wrote and recorded there for a year and a half or so.
That's wonderful.
That's awesome.
Yeah.
And how was the recording process different? How did that affect the recording process being in the new environment versus the previous LP?
I wasn't much the physical process as much as the emotional places. Everyone was in very kind of broken places. Like I saw some videos. I look terrible. I'm like 30 pounds overweight and JT's 30 pounds underweight and like we're just look kind of like a mess just from an emotional standpoint. So that scene, I remember it more for those reasons than the physical environment's kind of shaping the album. But a lot of the songs were, you know, dealing with a lot more adult themes probably.
Yeah.
So,
was that album released independently or how was it released?
So the short story for that is we were still on Universal Motown.
Uh-huh.
Universal Motown says, you know, we loved your first album. You're like our favorite band that we have signed, but we need 5 Katy Perry singles.
Right.
and we're like, have you heard our band before, right? Like That's not gonna happen.
That's such a contradictory conversation. We love your band. You're our favorite. Now changed completely.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, at that time, major labels, that's kind of like, you know, those are kind of conversations that would happen.
Mm-hmm.
So we made the best album we could given the restrictions we had on ourselves. They wanted something that they could go to radio with and have success with. They didn't want to spend money on us and not have a return on investment, which I understand.
Yeah.
But then it starts with those, with that pressure, it kind of starts changing the way you create and make art and write songs. Mm-hmm. So that was like the challenging part of that. So
for sure.
Yeah,
so did they, I mean, on the back end of the, after the release of it, did they see a return on their investment? How did that album do as far as sales go and stuff?
Well, basically, they didn't release it. Motown went under. Well, they didn't go under. They got dissolved.
Gotcha.
I don't know what the difference is. Maybe it's a nice way of saying they went under.
Sounds like it.
So then, instead of getting dropped like everyone else did, we got sent over to Universal Republic.
Oh.
Yeah, so we're like, oh, okay. Who are you guys? So the record was completely done, paid for, and Universal Republic was like, wait, who are you guys again? and we got assigned to some like guy who was like an assistant to some intern or something. They didn't know us from Adam. And then they're like, hey, you should you know, they start pitching us songs that we should record. We're like, we're like done with our album. Like, we just need a release date. So they just they didn't even know who we were. They didn't care. We couldn't get them on the phone. We didn't have any champions there. And they had just gotten like a bunch of like TV shows. I think they signed The Voice or something like that, which is like brand new at the time. So they were totally busy with that and couldn't be bothered with like dealing with us. So we basically took our album and left and self-released that album.
Okay.
So Tree of Hearts was just a label name that we made up and made our own label.
Gotcha.
And Tree of Hearts is like the name of this magic trick I do. I do a card tricks.
Good.
Yes. It's a play on Three of Hearts. It's you'll just have to see it sometime. Anyways.
Gladly.
yeah. So that one was self-released. You know, I was supposed to do a magic show at our album release party, and I totally did not do it. So.
Oh man. You're due for one then.
I know. I'm very bad. I'm very amateurish. I'm good compared to my friends, but
you know. Compared to people that don't do it.
Exactly.
That's so, awesome.
But and a real magician would not, you know, I couldn't even hold a candle to. So.
Right.
Anyways.
I was looking up Tree of Heart Records. Like, I was like, I've never heard of this in my life. And I one of those pages that say everything that's been released on the record label. And it's just that one album. And I'm like, oh, I feel like this is made up.
Yeah.
I feel like this is a made up thing.
No, I mean, it's real. But it's also really made up. So
yeah.
It depends on how you, so we just had to come up with
just like magic.
It's just like magic. No, magic's real. I believe in magic.
Magic's real for sure.
So we self-released it, and I feel like it did as well as Absence did on a major label.
Yeah, for sure. It did better, technically.
Yeah, I think technically it did better, yeah, actually.
It broke the Billboard 200, like not even Heatseekers, like the real one.
It did, for real?
That's what Wikipedia says, and Wikipedia doesn't lie.
Wikipedia is just full of truth.
You can look into that and see if that's actually true, but that's what we're going with. You broke the Billboard Top 200.
Awesome.
Congratulations.
Well, yeah, so and then it was just everything was self-funded, and we tried a radio campaign with our own money, and we tried hiring independent marketing people with our own money and stuff. So
how did that go?
It went well, but you can only sell so many albums independently before you just kind of hit a wall. Like you'll always have those like flukes that you'll read about like once a year, like a fluke, like, you know, Macklemore or like Civil Wars. Like there's always that like one completely independent artist that, you know, sells like goes gold or something or whatever. But like, for the most part, you hit a wall because you don't have money and resources to put into it.
Yeah.
You know?
Right.
So we took it as far as we could, which is great.
Did you have to spend a lot of money to get out of the whole Universal thing, or were they just happy to be done with that?
I probably can't talk about that legally, to be honest.
That's fine.
Can we skip over that one?
Yeah, we'll skip right on over it.
Just because I know you guys have probably, like, what, 3 or 4 million weekly listeners?
Yeah,
and I'm sure some of them are on staff there still.
You were right with, like, the three,
man,
three
you know
or
us too
four.
Well.
Yeah.
Ish. Dave, take it away.
Well, I aside from wanting to know more about the magic tricks, I kind of got caught up on that one. I'm just kidding. So what was it like moving on from that into a tour with like bands like Switchfoot and Mute Math? Did you kind of feel a growing fan base at that point?
Yeah, that is the thing, is that we felt like our fan base was growing. The more we toured, the more you know, people discovered us, and touring was our lifeline. It was the only way to really feel like we were connecting with fans. you know, social media was still growing. Yeah. It's so weird, like, how fast technology changes. But, like, I remember, like, being told when we made Absence, like, you guys need a Twitter account, I think. And we're like, what's Twitter?
Yeah.
Like, you just type, like, what you're doing? That sounds so stupid.
Yeah.
But now it's like, it's, you know, it's in our the worldwide lexicon.
Yep.
The word tweet.
It's wild.
So, anyways. Yeah, so it went well. But then, you know, then it was time to make another record. Every circle was a line, just connected by design.
Talk about that. You guys just released the third album.
Yes.
So talk about kind of there's a 4-year window in between the second album and the third album. So talk about what was going on in that 4-year window. Why did it take so long to release the third album and all that good stuff?
Yeah. Well, you know, we're slow. Number one, like we didn't take a break.
Yeah.
Like we didn't stop. We didn't take a break. There's actually a lot of factors, and if you add each of them up, it makes sense. But the first was that after the second record came out, we toured for 18 months. Mm. So we toured for a year and a half or so, which means you don't really have time to write. So then you get home and you're like, okay, let's make a record. And it's like, well, we don't have any songs.
Right.
Because we historically have written over 100 songs plus for every album, you know? Mm. And, you know, you only hear 12 of them or whatever's on the record.
Right.
But,
that's crazy.
But, so we didn't have any songs. And so we spent a year doing a bunch of different like exercises and started making this album and almost a year and kind of realized like, none of this is good. Like we have to throw this all away.
Ugh.
So,
oh, that's frustrating.
Yeah. So that's what we did. We're like, okay, this isn't working. We need to kind of like just do a lot of stuff and write a bunch of ideas and then bring them back together. So we kind of split up for a while, a few months, and just wrote by ourselves. And then decided we need to like do the thing where we get out of town and rent a place. So we found a place on Airbnb and rented it for a month in like the hills of Tennessee, like an hour outside of Nashville.
Nice.
And that's what we did. So
that's awesome.
But like the day we were packing up our studio to move out and move it into the new place, Gavin, our drummer, said that he might be leaving.
Hmm.
He had an opportunity to play with another artist. And so me and JT were like completely shocked.
Yeah. You know,
we're just about to start making our third record. And so then he, you know, so 2 weeks into making this record, like into this recording process in this house, he told us that he had made his decision and he was going to have to take the other drumming gig.
Ugh.
And leave paper out.
That sucks.
So that's when JT and I canceled the next day and he just came over to my house and we sat on the porch and that's when we like just literally were like, do you still want to do this? You know?
Yeah.
So.
But you did.
So we did.
Yeah.
But it was tough, you know? I mean, I was the best man in Andy's wedding. I was in Gavin's wedding. like, it's just tough to like lose your close friends. Not like lose them as friends, but just like,
yeah,
you know, for them to leave what you're doing is, it's just a tough thing.
Yeah.
So we had all this time, all this money spent on this house, and we, JT and I have like, you know, a long standing, really good chemistry, I think, but we both know that we need like a third person. We need like somebody else, like a different energy besides the two of us. And so we knew that we needed someone to balance us out. And so we asked Nick Aranda to come to the house and play guitar. He had been touring with us as a guitarist for a couple years.
Okay.
Like since the Peace of Wild Things tour, you know, when Andy quit.
Mm-hmm.
And so he dropped everything and came down to the house and was like an immediate like beam of light and just flourished, honestly.
Yeah.
And he was so positive and is so happy all the time that, you know, it was like a no brainer that we needed him in the band. And he's such like a musical, he's just like one of those guys that, you know, is so musical and hears things that nobody else does. And we could kind of throw anything at him and kind of like try to like stump him, and he would just figure out a way to get things done. So,
yeah. What did you do as far as drummers go since you don't have one anymore?
Well, JT and I both program lots of beats.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, we program tons of beats for this record, which is like one of our favorite things to do. JT also is a drummer, which a lot of people don't know, but he, you know, he's a drummer and a percussionist, so he can definitely hold his own on a drum kit.
Nice.
So he, you know, drummed on some of the stuff. And then, well, this is all, we'll get to that in a sec, but eventually our friend Darren King ended up drumming on most of the album.
Snap.
From Mute Math.
Yeah, right. He's the man.
You got the best drummer in the world.
Yeah, we got the best drummer in the world, and we wanted the best drummer in the world, so we got him.
It's great.
So yeah, so that's basically what happened, honestly. But that came after we got signed.
Okay.
So
who'd you get? Who'd you get signed to?
We were not signed. Well, we got signed to Kemosabe.
Okay.
Which is part of Sony.
Okay.
Okay.
Is so, it like the minor league of Sony, or not to put it like in a jerk, and not in a jerk way, but like, how does that play out as far as
but a baseball being term? Sony?
Yeah, a baseball term. Happy.
Yeah, it's more of like it's more. It's not really a minor league version of Sony. It's just that Sony owns. It's called an imprint, and so it's just like I don't know how to explain it. I'm trying to think. You know how like Aldi also owns like Trader Joe's?
They do. You're right.
It's like that. It's like, is Trader Joe's the junior varsity of Aldi? Not really. It's just different.
Yeah.
But yeah, it is. It's more minor league in terms of like size. Like it's smaller.
Sure.
But they, you know, Sony has, you know, they probably have 100 record labels or something like that.
Gotcha.
Technically, I'm not really sure.
Right.
It's kind of like how, you know, Disney owns a bunch of TV stations or something. So.
Gotcha. Yeah.
All that being said, we're in the Sony family, and they came to a show that we were playing in New York. We were unsigned. We had already started making this record, you know, paying for everything ourselves. And we had three people randomly come out to one of our shows who had never seen us before that all worked for Sony, and they just freaked out about the show and called their boss and, you know, hit us up and offered us a deal.
That's awesome.
And so we ended up signing it.
Yeah, that's great.
Yeah.
So you recorded...
Me and Brand, the last time me and Brand saw... Oh,
you go right ahead.
I was going to say, the last time me and Brand saw you guys was actually in New York when you guys played with Mute Math and back in March.
Oh yeah. Are you guys based? Is that where you guys are based?
Well,
I'm based in New York. Brand's from Greenville, but he was visiting.
Yeah, Greenville, South Carolina.
Okay, cool.
But I came up. Awesome. Part of the big reason I came up is because I wanted to see Dave, but also Mute Math and you guys were there, so it was a no-brainer for me.
Oh, awesome. Cool.
Yeah, loved it. Great show.
It's a great show.
Well, thank you. Thank you.
Yeah. So you record the album, you get signed, they release it, I'm assuming. That's how that works?
In theory, yes. But actually, this time to be honest, yes, Kemosabe did release this one. Yeah. Okay. But the Sony, there's another part of Sony called Sony Red that kind of partnered with them for the release.
Gotcha.
So that's just boring background stuff, but yeah.
Yeah. Well, just logistically, let's get it straight, you know?
Yeah.
So
that's what this band is. We straighten out things.
That's exactly right.
That's what you guys do.
That's right.
That's what we do on this podcast.
You're investigative podcast.
Really? If someone were to
That's add, more like, true than you know.
Yeah. So now that this third album's out, there's what? 34, almost 40 Paper Route songs, or actually more, because this album has what, 16 tracks on it. So there's a good amount of songs for people to go online and listen to Paper Route. What would you hope that people would take away from listening to all the Paper Route stuff? What are you guys as a band really trying to say through your music and through your lyrics that you're trying to get through to people through music?
You know, that's a good question, and I'm only part of Paper Route, so right. I can't really answer for everybody. And, but, you know, we always wanted to be creative. We never wanted to settle. We never wanted to rest on our laurels, and we always wanted to push. But we always also wanted to put, you know, kind of like the vitamin in the Twinkie, so to speak. And so we wanted, you know, songs that could stand the test of time and would be good no matter how they were produced or presented.
Yeah.
But we also wanted the music to be so good and compelling from how it was presented that you could get rid of the melody and the vocal and it still be a compelling musical moment.
Yeah.
You know?
So have the cake and eat it.
You have the cake and eat it, and surprise, it's made of kale.
Yeah.
So.
Well, kale cake. Those are the best.
Kale cake.
Yeah.
But
wrapped in some beautiful produced cream.
Yeah, there you go. But yeah, so basically, I don't know. We're pretty hyper emotional. We are sentimental creatures.
Yeah.
And so we kind of just, you know, I don't think we really write with a message kind of mentality.
Sure.
We write from like, this is kind of where I'm at and what I'm going through or what I want to say. And I don't even know why I want to say it. But so I don't think that we always start out with like the end message in mind, to be honest. I think that, you know, a lot of times we didn't really know what this album was about until we started getting asked, you know, about the lyrics and about the music and stuff. And it's kind of only understood looking backwards. And so,
gotcha.
So I'm not really sure, to be honest, because I'm, you know, I'm in the middle of it. We're all in the middle of it.
Yeah.
Right.
You know, a lot of people get a sense of hope from our music. Mm-hmm. Maybe not because we're spouting hopeful messages, but maybe because people are just like, oh, these guys are crazy, just like me.
Yeah.
You know, like I'm not alone. So, you know, a lot of this album is dealing with kind of more adult themes and, you know, mental health and our own personal struggles that we've dealt with, you know, in our 30s. And so,
yeah, absolutely.
So I don't know. I'm just kind of rambling. But all that being said, fine. You know, we want people to take whatever they want from our music.
Yeah.
So.
Just kind of a little bit, kind of as a follow up to that, for whatever reason, kind of similar to Mute Math, there's like this, mm-hmm. this weird, tie to you guys kind of sort of being in the Christian world, but then also not really at all. I don't know if you've seen that connection at all in your career. But we see it for sure with Mute Math, yeah, but totally. Also with you guys. So get, talk like as a band who's trying to create really good music, for whatever reason, there's this tie. So talk about the tension between that and the blurred lines of genres and stuff like that.
I'm allowed to drink a beer while I ask this, while I answer this question?
Absolutely.
Okay, hang on.
Let's do it loudly. Loud enough we can
hear it. You could open it, too.
All right. Nick's gonna
also, how you feel? Also, how do you feel with the old Cubs tied up with the Indians?
It's getting tense, guys. I'm just so glad that like by the time this podcast comes out, everyone's gonna know that the Cubs were became the eventual world champions.
Oh man,
Nick is siding with JT. Nick is siding with JT. He wants the Indians to win.
Wow,
I think it's really
exciting. I think it's bold of you to go with the.
Well, by the time this podcast airs,
that's true.
I have a 50% chance of being right. Yeah, it will be the truth.
You want to make a bet? Yeah, we can make a bet on the air too.
Let's make an on-air bet. Okay, so what was the question?
Something about
something about
Christianity or something
Christians.
Like that.
Christian question mark.
Yeah.
Yeah. So we definitely there's obviously a lot of it's you know we keep running into it and
yep.
I would, you know, it would be stupid of us to be like, what? That's so confusing. Why? but we'll do, I mean, like we said yes to this interview and I looked at all the interviews you guys have done and all the bands, most of the bands on your list all have some sort of ties to, you know, Christian music or, mm-hmm. or anything, you know?
We're trying to move away. I promise.
I don't believe you one second.
Just like every, that's what we all say. And
we all start in the Christian market and then we try to break out of it.
Mm-hmm.
It's great.
Yeah.
It's a wonderful starting point.
So it's honestly, it's a lot of like saying yes to things that are kind of already on the fringes. And honestly, we've said yes to some Christian festivals because we wanted to go to Europe. And at the time we're like, you know, we just said yes. Yeah, I don't know. I'm just being honest.
Yeah.
Like, we all grew up in various incarnations of the church. You know, Nick was signed to a Christian record label. JT and I were almost signed to a Christian record label, but were saved at the last second. No pun intended.
there it is.
But we all grew up in the church. I mean, but I don't know. We don't want to be anything we're not, you know. But like our spiritual, you know, this our spiritual health and lives are extremely important to us, but they're constantly in flux too. So, you know, where I am and where JT is and where Nick is all such different places.
Yeah.
Like I don't know. It's like we don't have a message. I don't know anything.
Right.
You know? Just when I think I'm just going through a spot where like I don't even know what I know. And yeah. I'm like okay with that. But yeah, but like the idea of like, you know, creating an industry or being a part of an industry that you know, that sells art like that. It's just not, we would never fit into that world, you know?
Yeah, for sure.
We're like too honest, I think, or something. I take that, but there's like, there are artists out there who can live in that world and do good work, I think. But I think they're more the exception than the rule.
Yeah.
And we have a lot of friends in that industry. So, and there are really good people. And I know a lot of people that have the right motives and the right hearts for that kind of work.
Yeah.
But I know myself well enough to know like that's just not a place I can be in, you know?
Yeah.
I have like a lot of, I have a lot of problems writing and being creative and being free if I'm thinking about the end result ahead of time,
mm-hmm.
you know?
Right.
For sure.
And I think that people that operate in that world, like just have to start with the ending in mind already, you know?
Yeah.
As far as, mm-hmm. you know, so,
yeah.
Well, that would also play into if that would also play into if you guys were more conceptual, I guess, with like a single goal in mind. Like you said, it's more natural than that with how you've made your records, trying to have a more general goal of making quality music with quality production, which is kind of a different thing than trying to create a mission statement or whatever in your music.
Yeah, I've dabbled in you know, Christian music in the past. Like, I've been asked to do remixes. I've done remixes for, like, you know, those platinum selling artists in that world.
Yeah.
And it's fun. Like, I'll push it as far as I can. But it's funny seeing, like, the backlash, like, online. It's like, you know, people think it's like the devil's music sometimes. Mm-hmm. It's like really funny.
Yep.
I mean, not funny. I mean, it's funny to me.
No, it's funny.
It kind of just
funny.
Speaks. It's funny, but it speaks to the fact. I mean, we had people looking at our album cover of our new album because it's the first time we're on an album cover, which is something that we always said we'd never do, which is why we were like, well, what's the most uncomfortable thing we can do? Put ourselves on the album cover. Okay, let's do it.
There you go. But, that's awesome.
So we had like these black and white squares on the floor with like the album credits on it, which you know, you can see if you look in the inside of the vinyl or the CD. But we had people, one guy was commenting like, are you guys like devil worshipers now? Because of like the black and white squares. Like, what?
Yes, we are.
Yes.
It's a good thing that I'm not in.
If I sold my soul to the devil, we'd sell a lot more records.
Absolutely,
that's for sure.
Yeah. It's a good thing that I'm not like.
Deal was made.
If I was in a remotely popular band, I would just mess with people on the internet, which is probably not a smart thing to do. But if somebody asked me that question, I'd be like, "Yep, I sure did. Sure did."
Troll the trolls. I don't know if that ever works out.
Yeah, I've gotten in a couple things, and I've actually done a pretty good job because I'm normally pretty intense and heated and reactionary, but I don't know. I just, you know, I have a hard time with dumb people who are bigots and racists and homophobes and everything. So. Yeah,
sure.
Yeah. Anyways, that's a whole other conversation.
Yeah.
Sorry, it must be the three sips of beer I had talking.
That'll push you right over the edge. And also the tied game and the bets.
I'm stressed about this game. I'm so glad that the Cubs are going to win, though. And all said and done.
Keep saying it.
So all that being said, I don't know how to even wrap that question up other than say, you know, yeah, we've all grown up in the church. I think that like a lot of great artists have some sort of religious or church background.
Sure.
And I think it's because a lot of musicians, like, where else can you go when you're 14 and have to play like six brand new songs that you've never heard before and have to learn them and then do the same thing the next week? Mm-hmm. Like, you just get to be a good musician and learn how to mess up and not have anyone know and, you know, like improvise and not get stage fright. So like a lot of musicians, especially, I find, have some sort of church background, whether it's Paper Out or like Marilyn Manson or Katy Perry, you know.
And also it gives you a chance to play with a lot of times more experienced musicians than yourself, whereas if you're in your like school band, you're like you and two other 14-year-olds that have no idea what they're
exactly.
doing.
Exactly. Yeah. Yeah,
so I totally avoided the whole,
I avoided the whole like punk rock phase. I don't know how. I think cuz I was
unfortunately,
like,
we didn't.
No, that's probably you guys are younger, probably. Like, I was like catching the tail end of grunge, so that's like what I want to do. Like, be really moody and grungy and wear flannels and, you know, that kind of thing.
I still struggle with that one.
Hey, it's just the struggle's real.
No doubt.
Yeah, it is. I mean, I live in Brooklyn and it's just a daily struggle.
Yeah, I'm sure it is. I bet you can't go 100 yards without seeing that.
No, you can't do it. And it spreads like wildfire.
I know. Awesome.
But yeah, and also, like, just I don't know. I think that it's such a large issue that there's no way to really, like you said, put it in a box. I mean, it's such a big thing to have that in your background, but not let it inform. But at the same time, it's not like you're neglecting it. It's just a thing that happened that is now there.
Yeah.
Yep.
Having that there.
Yeah, and I think, you know, we do our best to address that stuff and be honest and real.
Yeah.
You know, and so we try to write music that speaks about God and whatever concept we can come up with at the time.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, it's we're all in different places in our journey, and you know, I don't know.
Yeah,
it comes out in our music, and other things come out in our music. So,
but you're the only devil worshiper in the band currently.
Reformed
devil worshiper.
Devil worship.
That's fantastic. Speaking
are
of,
are you charismatic at all?
Am I charismatic?
Okay, let's.
Speaking
that's
of
a whole other can of worms. The answer is no.
Speaking of Christian music, speaking of Christian music, you mixed a couple of songs on the John Mark album. So I guess that's a thing you do too. You produce, you mix, and whatnot.
Yeah, I mean, he was actually one of the guys I had in mind when I was telling you. Like, I've met some people in the industry who seem to really have an original voice and.
Right.
You know, I believe, like, I can believe what they're saying.
Yep.
You know? And he's one of those guys. Like, I really think he's honest, and I love his lyrics. I love his voice. And so, but yeah, I didn't really ever plan on it. Like, I went to recording school and I started, you know, recording, and then I started producing. And I would just start mixing the stuff I produced. And then I would have other producers hit me up to see if I would mix the stuff they were working on. So, but yeah, all that being said, I have my own studio. I typically do more mixing right now because I don't have a lot of time to schedule producing, being on the road and stuff. But yeah, I do produce and mix. So yeah, I did mix the last couple of John Mark McMillan songs. And,
Love it. Yeah. So we'll wrap it up with what's next for Paper Route, and then also how can people find out where you're going and when you're coming. That was a weird way to ask that question, but we'll go with it anyways.
How can they meet up with you? What's the Tinder situation?
What's the Tinder situation for you guys?
Yeah,
what's the show Tinder?
What's the Tinder sitch? So
the next single from Paper Route, Tinder Sitch.
Tinder Sitch. What was the first part of the question?
What's next?
What's new for us?
What's next and where are you going?
What's next and where we're going? Okay, so we're on tour.
Great.
Promoting Real Emotion, which is I'm really proud of this album. Like, you know, we didn't get into all the ins and outs of making it, I guess.
Yeah.
But
it's long. Yeah. It's 16 tracks. Wait. Yeah.
Yep. 16 tracks. Yeah, that's a whole other conversation, but it is 16 tracks. but yeah, so we are on tour right now. We're doing the Midwest and the East Coast, and we have unofficial plans to do the West Coast early next year. We want to hit the whole country.
Fantastic.
We don't want to leave anybody out. And so we are planning on touring the whole country and then rinse and repeat, basically.
Yeah.
Tour, and maybe do some opening spots. Just kind of depends, you know?
Yep.
So that's the plan.
Great. Love it. Well, thanks so much, dude. Thanks for coming on our Christian podcast and talking about your band.
Well, hey, actually, Brian's the Christian, and then I'm the devil's advocate, in as literal a form as you can imagine. I'm with you on the devil worshiping. I'm just kidding.
Oh, no.
He's my go-to I have any questions about that world.
This is oh my gosh! Just picture us both on your shoulders and guess who's who.
Yeah, absolutely.
Well, I definitely normally do. I see you guys daily.
Great, wonderful.
Oh boy.
Thanks so much, dude. Appreciate it.
Yeah, thanks for having me, guys. Yeah. And tell your friends, tell your enemies. Paper Out, Real Emotion, in stores, and your favorite online streaming services. Now and forevermore.
you so much for listening, everybody. If you would do us a big favor, go like us on the social medias, all that good stuff. We're on Facebook, Instagram, Twitters. Like us there. Subscribe, review the podcast. It helps. It does indeed help. And that's it, guys. Come back actually Friday. We're putting out a bonus episode in May, so come back then. Until then, have a great week. Happy Election Day. Something like that. Bye.
Hi, I'm Richard Karn, and you may have seen me on TV talking about the world's number one expandable garden hose. Well, the brand new Pocket Hose Copperhead with Pocket Pivot is here, and it's a total game changer. Old-fashioned hoses get kinks and creases at the spigot, but the Copperhead's Pocket Pivot swivels 360 degrees for full water flow and freedom to water with ease all around your home. When you're all done, this rust-proof anti-burst hose shrinks back down to pocket size for effortless handling and tidy storage. Plus, your super light and ultra-durable pocket hose Copperhead is backed with a 10-year warranty. What could be better than that? I'll tell you what, an exciting exclusive offer just for you. For a limited time, you can get a free pocket pivot and their 10-pattern sprayer with the purchase of any size Copperhead hose. Just text WATER to 64000. That's WATER to 64000 for your two free gifts with purchase. W-A-T-E-R to 64000.
By texting 64000, you agree to receive recurring automated marketing messages from Pocket Hose. Message and data rates may apply. No purchase required. Terms apply. Available at pockethose.com/terms.